Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, also co-hosted by Shad Markowitz. We are going to lead you through this weekend's edition, starting off with comments on the resource sector and also precious metals. And then in the tail end of this first hour, we're going to get more into some of the broad market comments. I want to hope everybody has a great Labor Day, long weekend. I appreciate all of you for tuning in during this long weekend. And I think we're all looking forward to getting out of summer for the active traders to hopefully see some more volume pickups. And who knows, maybe a bit more stronger trends being developed here. Shad and I are kicking off the show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, we're going to start off with the U.S. dollar here, because the U.S. dollar was on a fairly nice uptrend, really, that started at the beginning of June when the dollar was just under 90 on the dollar index, continued to march higher just about 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, August 20th. That's when the dollar reached a high of just short of 94 on the dollar index and has pulled back currently right in that, let's call it 92 area. So still, the dollar hasn't exploded higher. It's actually traded in, for the most part, a range over the last few months, and now it's at the top part of this range. What are your thoughts on this, I guess, recent rollover in the dollar, but again, the dollar being at the upper part of its range? Let's start there.
Good. And to start, appreciate you having me back on the program here, Corey and Shad. Always good to join you. Yes, I've been following the DXY very closely here, and I imagine I'm not the only one that's doing so. You correctly highlighted that the dollar has been in a downtrend here really since late spring 2020. So obviously in the immediate aftermath of the coronavirus sell-off in February and March of last year, we saw a spike in the U.S. dollar. It has been in a downdraft since then, and that's provided a serious tailwind. Both to physical commodity prices, physical metal prices, as well as producers of them. And then as you go further down the food chain, you know, into the junior miners. So that's been wind in our sail for quite some time. We did see the dollar, however, bottom or potentially bottom in January of 2021. And as you mentioned, it had been kind of solidifying what seemed like a base for some time there. Then starting in June, about 60 days ago, it looked like it was going to make an attempt to break out of its downtrend. And the key level there was around 93.50 on the DXY. And we saw in the third week of August, around the 18th, 19th, 20th, DXY jump above that level, but it was unable to hold it. And it got pounded down, and I think it pretty convincingly failed, at least on this first attempt. And so not surprisingly, we've seen, you know, metal prices and resource equity prices in particular have performed very strongly in these 8 to 9 trading days since, as the market has realized here that this first attempt to break that level has failed. You know, personally, I the focus for MJG is individual security selection. I really try not to get bogged down in, you know, making macro forecasts or getting too tight into the technical levels. That said, it's helpful to have a sense for where we're likely to go next. And it seems to me that we're going to go down to 92 on the DXY here in the immediate term. So that's the next critical level. Once that's touched, we'll probably see one of two things. First option is that the DXY breaks down from that level. And in that case, it's probably likely that we'll see the DXY test its 52-week lows sometime later this year, which would certainly be good for resource equities. If that was the case, then we would very likely see the next upleg in this resource bull market that we've been experiencing here. Since at least March 2020, some would argue longer. Second option would be the 92 level holding, and then we see a retest of the 93.5 level, you know, in the coming few months. if that were the case, I think this, euphoria we've seen over the past couple weeks of trading, would prove to be short-lived, and there would be a lot of fingernail biting and concern as we retest the 93.5 level. So jury's still out. I do think we go down to 92. That could provide another, couple weeks of positive momentum in the juniors that we follow. From that point, it will be a key inflection point, and we'll see where we go from there.
Well, Matt, I'd be curious to get your take on how you think the dollar, basically in relation to all the other currencies, because it's not floating in a vacuum. That dollar index is weighted against the euro and the yen and the pound and the kroner and all of that. But also how that plays into what a lot of, let's say, precious metals investors are looking at. It doesn't always have to be inversely correlated, but as you mentioned, a weaker dollar is a tailwind for the commodity sector in general, but also for the precious metals. And a strong dollar tends to lean more deflationary, and so that presses the commodities prices down and is a headwind to the precious metals. But a lot of investors also think that in addition to the dollar, that for the precious metals markets to really take off, we need to see some weakness in the general stock market. So how do you think that all ties together as far as this recent weakness we've seen in the dollar and how that may tie into the general markets in the U.S.?
Right. I think you make some good points there. I mean, in the current environment, to simplify it, I would say, risk off mentality in the market would correspond with a strong dollar. Risk on would correspond with a weak dollar. So if we do see the DXY, move down to its lows, witnessed earlier this year, potentially break below those, I think that would probably be more positive for the non-precious metal commodities. So the energy metals, the base metals, industrial materials, really across the spectrum. I think it would be modestly positive for gold equities. I don't necessarily think it would be a disaster, but I think it's fair to say that if we continue with this risk on mentality that we've really been undergoing here for 18 months, that we can expect gold not to move in the same manner as what you'd expect with copper and some of these other commodities more linked to the global growth cycle. So I think that's a fair point. Obviously, if the 93.5 level were breached and we start to see the DXY, creeping up towards levels we last saw last year, that would spell, short term doom for the energy and base metal complex. It probably also results in kind of a capitulation event to some degree in the precious metal equities, at least in the very short term. But I think that would probably set the stage for a more sustained rally amongst the precious metals relative to the rest of the metals complex. So a little nuanced here. I mean, I think if you have exposure to the resource market broadly, your clear preference is for a weaker dollar from here. If you're all in on gold and silver, it's a bit more nuanced.
So Matt, big picture, as we turn the corner here, out of summer, look, it was really summer doldrums. It was slow trading, shares continued to drift lower, even as a lot of the metals and different resources, for the most part, trended sideways. One of the nuances about this summer, though, is that we did see a bit of a pullback in the base metals. But the base metals were on a huge run, and their run continued much longer than, let's say, the precious metals run did when precious metals topped out in August of last year. This year, it was about March when a lot of the base metals started to top out. But the fact of the matter is, even through summer, even how slow it was, commodities broadly underperformed the general market. To your point about more risk-on trading, what do you see coming out of summer? Because as much as we might look at the dollar or some other individual markets and sectors, fact of the matter is, I think to get more investors into the space, we need to see commodities start to outperform, or at least individual metals.
That's right. We're starting to see a little bit of that potentially with uranium, for instance, or nickel. These are both phenomenons of just the past few weeks for different reasons. But yes, going back to your point, I think the outcomes are likely grouped as follows. You have continued strong movement in the U.S. stock market. That's one option. And should that occur, that's probably going to be accompanied by a flat or weak U.S. dollar. And should this persist for another 3 or 6 months, then I think you're right. Commodities, resource equities generally will likely play a catch up because they have had a week, a relatively weak period here, really since mid to late June. So I do think there's the opportunity that we see, you know, another leg higher in this resource bull market as we head into the end of the year. Again, should the general markets stay strong? That said, and again, I've been, I guess, overly cautious to some degree when it comes to my view of the general markets. But I'm quite concerned. You know, when you look at the S&P, there's a few data points just from last month. One was a study from Goldman Sachs that showed that the median short interest as a percentage of market cap for your average S&P 500 company is at around 1.5%. And that in a vacuum doesn't mean too much, but with some context, the last time we saw this 1.5% short interest number was in 2000. So it'll often work as a contrarian indicator. That's very low. That means very few investors are short the market. You know, conversely, this number got as high as 4% in 2009 when folks were, you know, fearful in the immediate aftermath of the global financial crisis. And we know what happened then, you know, not for resource equities for most of that period, but we went on a record run there for the general market for well over a decade from 2009. So again, the short interest metric, not going to call a top with any precision, but it lets us know that we're closer to unfavorable prices than we are favorable prices. That much is clear. And then additionally, last month, GMO, that's Jeremy Grantham's group out of Boston, they put out some research showing that stock issuances, so companies issuing new equity and raising money here, they've surged to all-time highs, surpassing the previous highs, which were in 1999, again, towards, you know, what was a historic market peak at that time. And, you know, this is concerning because really nobody knows businesses better than the management teams themselves in a lot of cases. And when you see companies coming out and issuing equity hand over fist, that is an indication that they believe that their share prices are likely overvalued and they'd rather take in cash, you know, while the appetite's there. And so we've seen record share issuances. This both includes, you know, new issues of SPACs and IPO activity. But if you also strip out that data and just look at the, you know, quote unquote blue chips, those companies are also raising money at a record clip right here, which again generally accompanies the tops in markets. So that's concerning. And then I guess one more point that I'm a little surprised we're not hearing more chatter about, especially as we head into the end of the year, people start looking forward to 2022. So I think a lot of the reason this V-shaped recovery has been sustained over the past 18 months here is because of, you know, record stimulus coming out of Washington. It was a given that the Fed was going to respond in its aggressive manner, lowering interest rates, you know, quantitative easing, the whole shebang. But the response from Washington was a key differentiator from what we saw, say, back in 2008 for the global financial crisis. So that's obviously buoyed asset prices across the board. The issue there is, as we head into 2022, the November 2022 midterms come up. And it's important to note that in the midterm immediately after a new president's elected, this is going back 60 years in the modern era, the average result is a swing to the minority party by 31 seats. So in this case, you would expect the Republicans should, you know, history hold, to gain 31 seats in the upcoming midterms in the House. And the Dems only have 5 seats to play with. So historically, it seems very likely that there will be a split government coming into focus, you know, later next year. Folks will probably start to realize that this is the likely reality well before then. And then the implications there is that once this occurs, we can kiss any stimulus goodbye in 2023 and 2024. And I think as investors wrap their head around that could be a potential bearish narrative that starts to gain some momentum. So again, there's still worrying signs out there. You know, I think from a resource equities perspective, we have a great decade ahead of us. Prices are at historic lows relative to the general stock market. and it's going to be a good few years. But with the caveat, when there's that next major drawdown event, we will not be spared, as we all know here. These are risky, risk on equities, and when we go into a risk off event, investors in the space take it right on the chin. So I'm bracing myself for that eventuality. It's obviously hard to know with any precision when there'll be that change in sentiment, but nothing goes up forever, and we're seeing signs that we're getting close to the end.
Yeah, nothing does go up forever, but after 12 years of a bullish stock market, it sure feels like it. And some of the points you made, Matt, do seem like end of cycle kind of things with the SPACs, the IPOs, the huge mania into the tech stocks pushing the indexes higher, and then the That's huge right. amount of stimulus coming on board. So you did make the point there right at the very end, though, that the commodity sector is very undervalued relative to the rest of the stock market. Even though it had a nice little blip earlier in the year, there's still a lot of room to run. And when you focus on the base metals, I know you're focused on some of the battery metals, nickel, copper, uranium, lithium, et cetera. There's been some big news out in the nickel sector and the copper sector recently. Let's start with the nickel sector, though. Just very recently, there was the bidding war for Noront Resources, and then also some interest in Western Areas. There's a lot of other platinum, palladium, nickel projects that are building big projects, a lot of activity there. What do you make of some of these developments in the nickel space?
You're right, Chad. I will say there's been amazing intrigue around Noront, and we don't have a horse in this particular race, but I've been watching with interest from the sidelines. I guess the timeline here quickly for your listeners is that Wyloo Metals, which is a private company controlled by Australian billionaire Andrew Forrest, who was behind Fortescue Metals, they are Noront's largest shareholder. And in May, they made an offer, in hindsight, a quite opportunistic offer at 31.5 cents Canadian to take over the rest of Noront that they did not own. That was a hostile bid. The board and management were not in support. And a couple months pass, and then BHP comes over the top, which, in hindsight, wasn't all too big of a surprise. BHP has made it very clear that their intention is to go much deeper into the nickel business. They've moved their global exploration headquarters from Chile up to Toronto, and they're particularly keen on nickel in Canada. And they came over the top and offered 55 cents. And this was a friendly offer supported by Noront's board and management. And then just a couple days ago, to my surprise at least, Wyloo has now come in, and they feel like they're able to take on BHP here. We'll see how that plays out. They've come in and made an offer at 70 cents. That's not a formal offer, at least according to the company. So we'll see in the coming few days if that's submitted in a formal manner. If it is, we're talking a share price that is more than twice Wyloo's original offer of 31.5 cents just last May. So it'll be really fascinating to see how this plays out. I don't imagine BHP is gonna let Wyloo take this asset, but that remains to be seen. You also mentioned Western Areas, which is a lot closer to home for me. We are shareholders, for full disclosure, in the MJG fund of Western Areas. It's been a position of ours since spring, I think May of 2020. So a little bit over a year now. And funny enough, it's actually the only producing miner in our portfolio at the moment. Don't generally spend too much time on the producers. All of our cash flowing names, aside from Western Areas, are royalty players. But for this specific circumstance, I made an exception due to the quality of the assets, the people involved, and the valuations that we were talking about at the time. This would have been the third week of August, so just a couple weeks back. A financial Australian Times article came out mentioning that IGO was in talks to take over Western Areas potentially. And Western Areas management within 24 hours went as far as confirming that they were in talks with IGO, and they would let the market know if any formal agreement is settled upon. just a couple days later, Wailu Metals. So they're entering the picture again here. And Andrew Forrest is obviously looking very keenly at nickel assets. They announced that they had just crossed the 5% ownership threshold of Western Areas. And it turns out that Wailu, since March of 2021, so just over the past 4 or 5 months, had accumulated $38 million Aussie worth of Western Areas stock, and had just crossed that 5% reporting threshold. So now we have IGO with their hat in the ring, you know, confirmed by Western Areas. You now have Wailu, who's accumulated a 5% stake in Western Areas and seems potentially interested. And then, of course, there's the gorilla in the room, which, again, is BHP. So here's another scenario of Wailu potentially being pitted against BHP. BHP hasn't formally expressed interest in Western Areas up to this point, but they're a clear potential acquirer here for a couple reasons. The first is that of Western Areas' current nickel production, which comes from its Forrestania operations, which is comprised of the Spotted Quoll and Flying Fox mines, BHP already takes half of Western Areas' offtake material, and that's sent up to their Nickel West operation. That offtake is expiring in January of 2023, so they only have 18 months or so of that nickel material. And keep in mind, BHP is desperate for nickel material. So that's one reason. If IGO came in, they would lose out on any future nickel production from Forrestania, most likely, you know, as that offtake expired. You know, more importantly, Western Areas has their Odysseus asset, which is where most of the value comes from for this company. That asset, they put close to, well, hundreds of millions of dollars into constructing the mine. And just this month, they are going to be pulling first ore from the ground, which is pretty exciting. And they're projecting commercial production in roughly a year's time, we'll say in late 2022 here. And interestingly, at Odysseus, there's been no offtakes agreed to yet with any potential buyers of that nickel. And Western Areas has publicly said in the past couple weeks that they're going to finalize an offtake agreement for this Odysseus or sometime in the next few months. So, you know, reading between the lines, what seems to be happening here is Western Areas is dangling this offtake as Odysseus almost as a carrot to incentivize, you know, one of these three obvious parties to come forward with a formal bid. And then perhaps a formal bidding battle will occur. You know, my bet is that we will see a formal offer emerge from one of these three potential suitors before we ultimately see Western Areas announce an offtake for Odysseus. So it's quite another you know, dynamic situation there. I think it just goes to show that there are very few nickel sulfide development assets at a later stage of interest. You know, if you take Western Areas off the board, you take Noront off the board, there are really only a couple Aussie-based assets that we could expect to see production anytime in the next, you know, 12 to 24 months. There are some good nickel sulfide assets out there in places like Brazil or in Minnesota. But again, these are projects that are, you know, further down the development curve and still years away from production, even in a best case scenario. So I think groups like Western Areas are in a very attractive scenario. You know, groups like Mincor, Panoramic maybe fall into that basket as well. It's worth noting that Western Areas itself owns 20% of Panoramic. So it's likely that I think that we see more deals here beyond Western Area, as the amount of targets are pretty slim and the demand for nickel is only increasing.
So Matt, what about looking big picture for M&A outside of, say, the nickel sector? Because the nickel sector is generally smaller, less followed than, say, the precious metals. And look, investors have been clamoring, saying we need some more M&A activity. And we've gotten a whole handful of excuses as to why that M&A is not happening. But do you think the at least small uptick in some of these deals in the nickel sector could be foreshadowing some deals happening in other, maybe more widely followed resource sectors?
Potentially. I mean, I think precious metals are on a different cycle than nickel in particular. However, I would argue it's a very good environment, actually, in the precious metal front for further M&A. Usually when you see these euphoric periods like we saw last year, where gold, silver, and the associated equities, you know, rallied very strongly from, you know, April through, we'll say, August, September of 2020, you'll very rarely see deals made in that environment. Sellers don't want to sell. They see the gold price going up every day. They don't want to shortchange their shareholders. Buyers don't want to buy. They don't feel like they're getting a good deal, particularly if they could have gotten the same asset on the cheap just a few months before. However, as your listeners will know, it's been a painful 12 months for PMs and precious metal equities. And so now we're in a situation where I think multiple parties are likely at the table as we speak. We'll see if any deals are consummated. But there are quite a few good-looking development stage assets out there, both in Canada and the United States. A few names are coming to mind. So I do think we'll see some M&A on that front. But again, that's for different reasons for nickel. Precious metals is more where we are in the market cycle, and the fact that I think we see the conditions where sellers and buyers are willing to come to the table. Nickel, it has more to do with the insatiable demand for nickel sulfide concentrate in the immediate future here, and the fact that there are very few new sources of supply for the next couple years. So that's more out of necessity, whereas for gold and silver, it's more just positive deal making environment. I'll also note that in the copper royalty space, we've seen quite a bit of action just in the past few weeks. This would have been the third week of August, and for many of your listeners, that would have been the most painful week of the year, at least for those of them that hold resource equities. Fortunately, I was distracted by a handful of deals, so that was actually a pretty exciting week, all things considered. First, the aforementioned Western Areas, you know, takeover battle started in earnest. That's when the original article came out, and then confirmation from Western Areas. Secondly, at the beginning of that week, we saw Nova Royalty, which is the largest MJG holding and a position I've written about in our past few investor letters. They announced the acquisition of their first cash flowing copper royalty. This is the Aranzazu asset in Zacatecas, Mexico. It's run by Ara Minerals, which is backed by one of the founding families behind Yamana. A billion-dollar plus mid-tier producer. That's Ara Minerals, and you know it's looking likely that the mine will generate, at least at current prices, we'll say, you know, US $1.5 million, maybe up to $2 million in cash flow per year. Nova only paid $9 million for the asset, so you know we're looking in the range of potentially a 5 to 6 year payback here. If all goes to plan, we'll see production at Aranzazu doubled over the coming 2 to 3 years. So at least for Nova shareholders, that's the most immediate catalyst that we could hope to see on the Aranzazu front. And then down in Chile, we saw a flurry of activity around the Caserones copper asset, which is in the Maricunga belt down in Chile. Owned by a Japanese conglomerate JX Nippon, and they've spent $4.5 billion building that asset. I think we saw first production start there in 2014 or 2015. There was a painful few years there with ramp up issues, but they seem to have sorted out those growing pains, at least up to this point. And so, you know, on that week, the third week of August, we saw EMX and Alta Strategies, which both happened to be holdings of the MJG fund. So that was exciting to see. We only have 22 publicly traded positions in the portfolio. The fact that we saw two of them team up to do a deal was exciting. You know, there's a potential reason for that. Both of the companies are well supported by Sprott Global, Rick Rule's former group out of Carlsbad, California. And then additionally, they have overlap with Michael Wynn, who serves as a director on both of the companies. Needless to say, both of them spent $34 million U.S. To buy to what amounts to a 0.42% NSR on Caserones. And then just a few days after that, the Nomad Royalty came in and announced a deal for $27 million U.S. to buy a 0.351% NSR on Caserones. And this is in addition to Nomad having bought a 0.28% NSR in May of this year. So we saw a flurry of activity around the Caserones asset. News just came out within the past 24 hours, which probably explains why. It was just announced that a Chilean court has backed a $42 million remediation plan submitted by JX Nippon to regulators. And this uncertainty, the fact that this decision was pending, likely explains the seller's motivation to de-risk their exposure to Caserones, because there was always the chance that the court would come back and say, no, we don't expect that. We don't accept this. It should be, 2x higher, 3x higher, or what have you. So this news just from the past 24 hours is, modestly positive. It's positive news for the operators and, of course, for Nomad, Altus, and EMX. However, it does go to highlight that there are some community issues around this mine, and it's incumbent upon the operator to be reasonable with locals, make sure to follow this remediation plan to a T, and hopefully behave in a manner so that there's not conflict or future liabilities incurred. So, it's a bit of a word of caution to the asset, but at least in the short term, a positive result nonetheless for all the parties involved.
All right, Matt, we're wrapping it up here. Thanks for all those insights on a wide range of resources, and especially outside of the precious metals as well, because we do spend typically a lot of time on precious metals, but always good to see what's going on in some other sectors, especially when M&A starts picking up. Matt, great chatting with you, buddy. Thanks for taking time on this weekend. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And in these final two segments of this hour, Shad and I are chatting with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. He also writes a retail newsletter called In the No Trader, and a piece called 7-Eleven, where Rick chooses no more than 7 out of 11 spider ETFs. Rick, I want to start with the U.S. equity markets because, look, it's been a pretty slow summer. The summer doldrums was a very reasonable and accurate way to explain it. But for U.S. equity markets, they just kept grinding higher. There's a lot of different factors that we can talk about, but I just want to start with general price action for U.S. markets, the broad averages. Rick, how much higher can these go in your eyes?
Good question. If I had to, how much higher over time? A heck of a lot higher. Over the near term, I'm thinking that what I've been telling clients is that from 45.60 in the S&P up to 46.50, so kind of that 90 points, which these days is about 2%, I expect the S&P to have some difficulty in just easily pushing through the way it has so many other different levels. So as we kind of get close to it now, we're not far away. We're at 45.30-ish, so we're only a percent away or so from the bottom end of that range. I think it'll struggle a bit. If I look at longer term charts, I certainly can target 4,900, and that's kind of a measured move coming off of the March 2020 low. And back in 2013, when I was at Wells Fargo, as head of cross-asset trading strategy, I remember publishing a report that said that the S&P will be at 5,000 in 10 years from now. Actually, it was now that I think it was 2014. It was June of 2014 because I knew it was 2024. And people laughed at me because the S&P was at 2,000 at that point. And here I am putting out a 5,000 target 10 years later. We're certainly getting very darn close. And I don't think we have to stop in around 5,000, but that is kind of a place that a long time ago I was able to decipher and expect that we'd have a massive bull market that could get us there over a 10-year period from what was then 2,000. So when I look at where we're trading now, I look at where I have some shorter-term targets, I look at 5,000 as kind of a longer-term target. You know, it kind of gives me a sense that there's still a chance of as much as maybe 10% higher before we get a pullback that, you know, is a more meaningful one. And I'm not talking about a 5% pullback, but something that is, let's say it could be 10% or more. Am I looking for a bear market, which many people will qualify as a 20% pullback from a high? Not likely.
What about the whole crash scenario that we're hearing from a lot of commentators, too, saying a big correction, not just a bear market, but a crash is coming?
Yeah. Well, how many of those people said that, 500 S&P points ago and 1,000 S&P points
no,
ago?
Plenty. I hear you, Rick. For the last decade, right? I've been saying that.
Right. And certainly since we saw the big sell-off in 2020 in the early part of the year, you've had people fighting this all the way up. For a long time, I've kind of thought about this 5,000 neighborhood as being the place that this was targeted for. And look, we haven't seen a 5% down move since last November. 5%, even if we got it, in the balance of today is only half a trading day, that would kind of be crash-like. But, even if it came sometime in the month of September, it's not a huge thing considering where we've come from back in 2020. We were under 2250, right? So the S&P has doubled in a year and a half. And we haven't had this 5% pullback since last November. So, a move like that can happen anytime. Bearish news that's longer lasting than the typical 24 to 48 hours, which bearish news hits the market these days and just creates another buying opportunity for most people. Sooner or later, we're going to have something like that. It's going to come. But you can't really play for it. And when it does come, let me frame it this way. When we get a correction, it's still going to be a buying opportunity. So I'm not going to buy a 2% pullback, but if we get to levels that I can determine are places that I would expect buyers to re-show up, and I think that's going to be an ongoing process for a while, then I'm still basically in bullish mode. And then the question becomes just where you pick your places to add exposure over time and where you might trim some over time just simply because of either we start finally getting into a trading range that lasts, 6 months or something that you can get some sense of back and forth, which you don't really get these days. It's a straight up move. We 7 times we've already tested the 50-day moving average since last November. And something as simple as that has been the answer to when to get your best bargain opportunities in S&P terms. But Corey, you also, and Shad, you have to think about the fact that despite the S&P and the broad cap indexes making new all-time highs, there's a lot of stocks that are not participating anything like that. Russell 2000 breadth is a very different picture than S&P 500 breadth. So you've been in a sideways to lower range in that for a while. Mid-cap breadth has been pure sideways. Only the S&P 500 has continued kind of in the bull market. So it's a big cap rally, and the big cap names are what pushes, the benchmarks, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ indices in their calculations. So you've had plenty of stocks that people have gotten hurt on despite the fact that virtually every day we're making new all-time highs.
Yeah, Rick, I was going to ask you about that because people are piled into really the same dozen or so high-flying names, and that's driving the index up, especially in the S&P and sometimes in the NASDAQ. But like you mentioned, the Russell 2000 and really the market breadth in general, there's a lot of sectors or there's a lot of smaller niche sectors that are not participating. I like your approach and how you pick 7 out of the 11, you know, main ETFs that are either moving or not moving. What ones do you have your eye on that are undervalued that could possibly move higher at this point then?
Well, so in that 7-Eleven report, the goal of that report is to beat the return of the S&P 500 by being in no less than 5 or more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs that are the macro ETFs like XLB, XLE, XLK, etc. We just last week, I upgraded energy, which has been, you know, had an abysmal several months. After being the best performer and sharply outperforming the S&P this year, kind of dove, and I was just waiting for my signals to show up to come back in, and they showed up last week. So I've upgraded energy now and think that that's a sector that the names have pulled back enough on that you're going to get outperformance from them. So it's one of the sectors, too, if you think of, gee, if you have some extra cash, should you buy spiders? I actually would rather buy XLE at this point because I think it'll do better. So that's probably my favorite name or sector to go into now that you know, has been beaten up over the last several months, thinking that that bottom is probably being made right now and that, you know, you can get some outperformance again from energy.
So, Rick, big picture then, as we move out of summer, where are some of the key catalysts in your eyes for these markets to either continue to drive them higher or produce a short, maybe shallow correction? We hear a lot about Fed policy. We hear a lot about economic data that really gets taken on the flip side of it. If you get bad economic data, then everyone says, oh, the Fed's going to stick around, so that's going to be good for the markets. Or is it even outside the U.S. that we should be looking? Where do you think key catalysts are going to come from?
I think now what we've got to still kind of think about is that with the summer ending, that is going to likely increase, as you get into colder temperatures, and kids going back to school, you know, let's call it, you know, COVID, whether it's the Delta variant, but you're probably going to see a jump in cases as we go into the fall. And, you know, clearly the market wasn't happy with it last year, and certainly the early part of the year before everything started rebounding. And look, COVID, nobody wants to see anybody get COVID. Nobody wants somebody in their family to have COVID. But in general, even the virus is, initially, it's not going to make a material effect on corporate profits until it spreads enough that it materially changes the consumer's purchasing power and or corporations from, because of supply chain issues and things that have been in effect because of COVID from 2020, until you see that hit up again. I mean, my wife and I ordered a new couch for our living room in, I think it was the first week of February, and it just came 3 weeks ago. It was supposed to come in May, and then it got delayed, and then it got delayed. So we ended up getting it in like mid-August. And the explanation was supply chain issues. And it's stuff like that that, you know, could ultimately slow the economy down, depending upon how bad Delta variant gets in the fall. And you could see trickle-through effect, in which case maybe people say, you know what, we can always buy stocks again, but let's take some profits. And so that's certainly, to me, a key thing. You know, looking outside this country, part of it can be, again, how bad, let's say, European cases get and Asian cases get. Because if factories close down, that's going to affect, again, supply chain and potentially then corporate profits. If Europe, let's say, closes their countries down from visitors coming, you're going to affect tourism. Look today, even the worst performers, you know, are the cruise lines today. So I don't think it's going to be a huge effect. You're not going to see a decline like you saw in the first quarter of 2020, but could, given the upward trajectory of this market without any, you know, real correction of significance, could it happen? Absolutely. And when it does, you know, I'll be prepared for it. I have some cash on the sidelines waiting. And I've even told, you know, clients how, and I'm not going to mention it, how we're doing this specifically, but that if you want to hedge your books and your equity exposure, one of the ways that I think to do that is to buy put spreads on whether you want to do it on the S&P or NASDAQ or wherever you have, you know, the exposure that you want to hedge. You buy a put spread, so you'll buy the put of the higher price of the two strikes and sell the lower strike against it, which reduces the cost of the hedge, but it also doesn't protect you against a crash and essentially gets you long as you get closer to that lower put price. And that's okay by me, because I don't think this whole thing is going to fall apart to the point that, you know, you devastate this market and you go into an extended bear market. So if something happens, you know, I'm still, like right now, if I'm looking for a put spread, I might do something in the S&P. Again, we're roughly trading at 45.30. You know, I might buy 42.5 puts and sell, I don't know, 4,000s or 39.50s against it, something like that. I don't think, you know, we go down much more than that. I don't see us getting whacked all the way down to, you know, 3,300 or something, which was the all-time high going into the 2020 huge decline. You know, so I don't see us falling 1,200 S&P points or anything like that. So I still think in general, this is a bull market that at some point gets its correction, and you live through the correction. Hopefully you're hedged some of your book for it, and then you put exposure back on.
Well, Rick, one question that comes to mind is, you know, while we may not see the crash and we may not see something that's very prolonged, there's a lot of pundits and a lot of articles we see out in the financial mainstream media talking about a potential slowdown in the reopening trade. You mentioned cruise lines, really the whole hospitality sector, airlines, hotels, rental cars, will take it on the chin if there is less traveling this winter and if we don't open up the borders to travel to other countries. But there's also, you know, the potential that we may enter that stagflationary kind of environment like we saw in the 70s, where we still have some rising inflation to some degree. Some of that may be supply chain related, but some of it may be stickier inflation. But we may see a slowdown in growth. How do you see that may affect? Could we just grind sideways in these markets for a long period of time and just frustrate people? Or what's your outlook there if we got into more of that stagflationary environment?
Well, my guess is that the next, let's say 5 years, the growth in market terms, so let's say price appreciation, probably won't match anything like we've seen in the last year and a half. As far as, you know, if you annualize the last year and a half and you look at the move from 2250 in the S&P to 4500, a doubling, so a year and a half, so that makes it, you know, two-thirds of that. That's probably going to be a heck of a lot better than you'll see going forward in the next 5 years on average. So we definitely could get slowed growth. You could get slower or lesser returns in the market. And as you get the rotations like you do, you could be in a larger sideways type environment. But I think the people who are calling for a crash, and I've been around, this is now 40 years on Wall Street. So I've lived through crashes, crash in 87, you know, the 96 crash with the long-term capital blowing up and the Russian debt crisis. And then, you know, 07, 08 into the 09 bottom. I've seen them before. I've lived through them. I've traded them. I'm very familiar with them and the flash crash in 2010. But I think that you've got to still keep your exposure in stocks. Again, you can reduce some, but to play for a crash to me is more let's call it a combination of ego and calling for something that if it doesn't happen, most people are going to forget about. But if it happens, you get to be, you know, on the cover of Wall Street Journal saying you called the crash. The thing is, over the years, you know, if we go back to the 1987 crash, two well-known Wall Streeters predicted that crash, got very famous for them for making that call. And then that was kind of the last time that they were famous for making a call, you know, and it's over 30 years later. Calling for a crash is so you can say, I told you so. Look at a 100-year chart of the S&P or the Dow or, you know, any major index, and it's going to start in the lower left-hand corner of your screen and end on the upper right. And to play for the occasional times that you get these, you know, events that change things quickly is kind of a fool's game. There's no better place to be invested than in the stock market over time. And let's keep crypto out of it for the time being, because that's just, you know, you can't count on steady returns without taking 50% drawdowns all the time. So, you know, when you think about what is truly accepted as an investment, you have real estate, you have equities, you have bonds, you have, you know, commodities, hard assets. Almost everybody realizes that equities are the place to be when you have a when you're minding a long-term portfolio. So even if we get a pullback, and even if it was 1,000 S&P points, which would be, you know, over 20%, and you'd be in, quote, a bear market, we're not going back down to anything near 2020 lows. I'm not sure we're even going to be near early 2020 highs again in this market. So I think you think about a bond market that probably is going to lead towards higher yields over time. That's the way I'm playing it. That's the way I'm positioned. I have very few bonds left in my portfolio. I've hedged almost my entire book. Where's all that money going to go that was in the bond market if people start selling out of bonds and the interest rates go higher? A heck of a lot of it is going to go into the stock market.
Fair enough, Rick. So overall, though, still sounds like very much a buy-the-dip mentality in the U.S. equity markets. Let's shift focus a little bit to commodities then. What's your outlook for something like the precious metals? After now just over a year-long correction, gold went down on a flash crash just a few weeks ago, tested that 1675 level, right back to around 1800. We're ending the week here with gold moving higher on the back of that weaker than expected jobs report, but still right around that 1830 level. Still a lot of work to do on the upside. What is your outlook for gold?
I was very concerned on that, what you're calling, you know, the crash down from, you know, what was almost, I don't know, 1800 down to 1675 in a matter of 2 weeks. But being that we stopped where we did at 1675, which is now a triple bottom on a long-term gold chart, I was tempted to sell out of my gold holdings, but I didn't, and I'm glad I didn't. You know, one of the things that investors often lose sight of is the time that price spends at a certain level, not just the price itself. And the reality is that if you look at a gold chart, let's say you look at a weekly bar chart of gold, and you go back 3-4 weeks to that week that sold down, you know, we closed near the upper end of the range that week. So you had a spike down, and you know, it was not fun watching gold go from 1750 to 1675 in 2 days. But then it rebounded, and so it spent very little time. It was another spike low into a pure horizontal support line at 1675. So the fact that it was a spike and we spent no time down there meant that weak-handed longs got knocked out, and the people buying what the weak-handed longs were selling out were probably more investors. People said, I'll take advantage of other people's pain and buy what they're puking out. And the fact that gold has been up now every week since then makes me think gold is okay. I mean, we're getting closer to the downtrend line from all-time highs. And if you can pop through there and then take out the 2021 highs, or let's say the mid-year highs from the spring, somewhere near, I don't know, 1925, I think it was, then gold should be able to test its all-time highs and possibly even, you know, go higher. So I'm still sticking with gold. I certainly have a line in the sand now beneath 1675, and I wouldn't really want to have to give back that much. But the market clearly showed that that level was a pure kind of flash crash type event, and there's been straight buying since then. So I like gold.
Yeah, Rick, we definitely want to see that 1675 triple bottom hold, and it has been a little bit more peppy lately. One question I have, just following up on your previous comment about some of the rotation out of bonds, you mentioned that you think a lot of it will go into the general markets, but we've also been in that negative real rate environment where we've seen inflation creeping up. And what I was alluding to earlier with the 1970s comment on the stagflation was that we may see inflation stay sticky, and if rates, even if they go up some, if real rates are still negative, that's traditionally a good environment for gold. Couldn't some of that money leave the bond market and in pension funds or large institutions, couldn't some of it land in gold as a way to at least have their money not depreciate so much as it would be sitting in bonds that are getting eroded by inflation? Do you think it's possible there'd be a rotation from bonds into gold as well as the general markets?
I think it's possible you'll see some trickle into gold. But if those funds aren't invested in gold yet, then I'm not sure, you know, some of it is because the mandate of the fund doesn't allow them to go into an asset like gold. But let's say they have a mandate that allows them to, yes, you could see some trickle into gold. You might see more go towards cryptos simply because the human mind and behavioral analysis suggests that people like to be in what other people are making money in. And being that, you know, Bitcoin's back to 50,000, Ethereum's making new highs, actually even outperforming Bitcoin these days, or actually Ethereum's near its high. It's the type of thing that you may see that cryptos become more of an accepted asset class simply because you don't want to be, you know, fear of missing out, the FOMO type thing. And if corporate boards allow, imagine if they even let up to 2% of a bond fund have assets in crypto, what the inflows can be over time. I still have a hard time getting a handle around cryptos as a truly acceptable investment, even though I've got money myself in Ethereum and I've made 50% this year, you know, so I can't complain. But if any of that becomes more accepted, then the exit out of the bond market, certainly you'll see money go into equities. You might get some into, you know, the gold market, but you may very well see this again, a certain percent. I can't see any major pension plan saying, you know, you can go up to 10% in crypto. I think that would be hugely speculative and not in the best interest of the people who are relying on that pension plan down the road. But even a small percentage in, you know, some of these companies have billions of dollars in their pension plans. So even, you know, 1 or 2% allowing into some type of asset like that can make a huge difference. So I think to answer your question, Chad, that yes, some will trickle into gold, but I think there's also this, the crypto people have done a heck of a good job at marketing something. Whether or not it's it's valid, that's a whole different story. But it's becoming, rightly or wrongly, more accepted. And that's a place that even I would tell my kids who, you know, I've gotten them to invest in their 20s and put away money. I have a son who's 20, how old is he? 23, and he already has a Roth IRA. And just, you know, sent me an email the other day that he wants to add another $750 into it. And where should he put it? You know, I might tell him, put a third of it into crypto and then the rest into stocks. Just, and he's got a you know, a 40-year hold on this before he's going to touch the money. But I just think that bonds are not the place, as, you know, as an investment. They're not going to do you any good over time. And if rates go up, you're going to lose more money. You'll have capital depreciation in your bonds. You'll lose more than the interest rate that you're getting. I just think I just can't get into the idea of owning bonds with such low returns.
Okay, Rick, a follow-up question then, real quick, for cryptos. It's been interesting to see Ethereum outperforming Bitcoin. Now, both are moving higher, so to your point, right, outperforming assets do draw more attention than those that are underperforming. But this move into Ethereum, is that telling you is something more about this market, too, that it's maybe a different type of investor, too, that's entering this market and taking a different look at cryptos broadly?
You know, it might be. My stepson was, I have three of them, and two of them were particularly into cryptos, and we were talking when I was kind of a total naysayer, and I was a naysayer even, I think, just before I decided to put some money in, fully recognizing I could lose all of it, but so I was willing to put in an amount that I was comfortable that if it disappeared from my life altogether and crypto went to zero, it wasn't going to change my life. He convinced me to get into Ethereum rather than Bitcoin because of its actual practical usage, and that it made sense to him, who had done the research, that it made more sense to be in Ethereum than Bitcoin. So I bought some Ethereum myself. I don't know much about Cardano or any of these other ones. You know, pretty much both Bitcoin and Ethereum have futures contracts that the Chicago Mercantile Exchange has listed. And if they've listed it, you can have some pretty good assurance that these are the cream of the crop of cryptos. So there are Bitcoin futures, there are Ethereum futures. Now you can trade them. You know, there's plenty of other ways to trade them besides having a futures account. But the fact that those two have listed futures say to me that these are far more legitimate than Dogecoin and, you know, all these, there's God knows how many of crypto coins that you're playing a complete guessing game. At least these, I know, have institutional participation by the fact that they're listed as futures contracts. I just personally feel more comfortable because of that. It gives me more confidence in Ethereum than any other one besides, let's say, Bitcoin. But I chose Ethereum because of, you know, the supposed use of the actual coin as compared to, or the ether, the process that ether creates as compared to any other coin other than Bitcoin. So.
Okay. Well, Rick, we'll wrap it up there. That's some interesting comments on cryptos and also the potential money flows that we could see if the markets, or well, really, if treasuries start to sell off too, and where that money might rotate. Look, I think we're all looking forward to getting out of summer and having a bit more active trading, and who knows, maybe some new trends being established as well. Rick, it's great having you on the show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in this weekend. We're going to be back on it a little after the long weekend, back on Tuesday. And again, that's after Labor Day, so we're all expecting a bit more traders back at their desk. Rick, thanks again for your time this weekend. Have a great rest of your weekend, buddy.
Thank you, guys. A pleasure, as always.